Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What's happening, friends? Welcome to another episode of IGN Unfiltered. It is our monthly interview series where I have the great privilege of sitting down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. Except this month, I'm standing with... Well, I'll explain in a moment. Hang on. Although you probably already figured it out if you're watching on video. Sean Crankle is my guest. He is the co-founder of Night School Studios. And if you're going, I kind of know... That name sounds vaguely familiar. This will do it for you. Oxenfree. That was your breakout game from a few years ago. Just fantastic adventure game.
Thank you.
Teenagers, adventure, death,
possession.
It's all kinds of
party.
Stuff going on. And you've followed that up now with After Party, which is out October 29th.
Yes.
On pretty much every platform, mostly to start. The Switch version will come later. So we'll get to all that. You're not here for your health. We are promoting a new video game. But before we get started, first of all, Sean, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much.
You're my guinea pig. So I thank you for that, because you might notice if you're watching on video, if you're listening on audio, please check out the video this month, because we're in our new bar arcade. I think I legally can't say barcade. I think somebody owns that. That's like a trademark thing.
Ridiculous.
It might have just gotten bleeped right now. I'm not sure. But yeah, we're here. We've got our setup. We've got some cool set dressing, which I think maybe one of the shots I'll pick up. And then a functioning tap. Cheers, my friend. Yeah, I'm not good at...
Don't lie. This is your basement. We're in his basement.
Yeah, so you got it functioning. This is a... Mm. It's a pilsner of some sort.
I like it. I'll take more.
It's solid. So the goal is not to get you drunk, but if you end up that way and tell a bunch of crazy industry stories, yeah, well, that'll only make the show better. So, you know, feel free, is I guess all
it's
I'm saying.
It's just a normal thing. Say, I'm
down. Just pretend it's GDC or E3.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of me. Let's get back to you. You're the star. You're the reason we're here. Sean, so... Oxenfree was awesome. After Party's looking great. I got to play it around E3 time. It's out October 29th. PC, PS4, Xbox One, and Xbox Game Pass.
That's right.
So that's good. If you're a Game Pass subscriber, just play it.
You just get it.
Just be there. But I always like to start at the beginning. We're gonna go back in time. Take me back in your brain. What were some of your favorite games growing up? I want to figure out how we got to where you are. Yeah, let's hop in the Wayback Machine.
We're going to go pre-Super Nintendo.
Good.
We're going to go pre-NES.
Oh, okay. You don't look that old. You don't look that old.
I'm older than you think. We're going to go wood-paneled Atari 2600.
Really?
We're going to go probably that bad Spider-Man game. You remember the Spider-Man
game?
No.
See, NES is my jumping off point.
Okay, yeah, so my dad got us an Atari 2600, and all I remember was that. Also, yeah. It was a horrible Pac-Man game. It was like the worst port of all time. But Spider-Man, you just had like a single-color building, and then you shot like a massive pixel... wide web up the side of the screen, and then you just fell over and over and over again. So that's how I fell in love with games. But then Yeah, probably Mario 3. I mean, all of mine are going to sound like everybody else's.
Super Mario 3 though. It's just... it's your story.
So great. But then a lot of the, you know, like the LucasArts stuff is massive.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Day of the Tentacle in particular, although Sam & Max, Maniac Mansion. I played Maniac Mansion on NES. I didn't play it on PC.
Yeah.
Which was just a slog. Have you played that recently? Have you tried it?
No, not in a little while. Yeah.
It's brutal. I mean, you can still microwave a hamster, but it's rough. But yeah, I would say definitely, you know, like all of those that I mentioned. But my favorite of all time, Link to the Past. I've probably played Link to the Past, I don't know, 30 times.
That's a solid answer.
So good. Perfection.
We got Link's Awakening out now. So yeah. that's you can't beat that. Yeah, it's good times. But all right, so you've been gaming since you were a kid.
Yes.
Let's fast forward to you're growing up. You're starting to figure out who Sean is, what yes. Sean's going to be. Tell me, I learned so much. I love doing this show for a million reasons. One of them is I just learn all kinds of crazy stuff about each of my guests as I prepare for these things. You worked on a late 90s soap opera television show called Sunset Beach.
Wait, before that?
Before that. Okay.
I worked at EB Games in the Lombard Mall across from EGM for like 5 years.
Nice.
As a preteen into teenage years.
Yeah,
first job kind of thing. Slinging Donkey Kong Country with a big orange hat on my head. and then I got an internship out here, or out in Los Angeles when I was 19, and that would be for that show. So it was called Sunset Beach.
Yeah.
It was this failed Aaron Spelling daytime soap opera. So my first introduction to LA was like, oh yeah, of course you hang out with like the Spellings and you go to this block long mansion and actually threw up in Aaron Spelling's bowling alley underground by mistake. This is already off to a horrible start.
Well, let's press pause for a second. How do you end up with an internship? So where are you from originally? Is it Chicago?
Grove, Illinois. So it's like 20 minutes outside of Chicago.
Okay. Yeah. So how do you get from Chicago? Did you want to go out west into the games or entertainment industry? What's
entertainment for sure? I was going to school in Chicago at Columbia College for film.
Okay,
so this was like a writing internship that a friend of the family was actually a writer on this series, Sunset Beach, and she had written on all the Days of Our Lives, all these other soap operas, and it was like, will your parents let you go out there and live alone while you're 19? And I made the case everywhere, and I got credit from Columbia, talked them into it, and I dropped out of college. So didn't matter, but I pushed and pushed and moved out and stayed for those 3 months. And I was like, I just need to stay out here and start working.
I mean, that must have been like, if that had happened to me at 19, I'd have been freaking out. That would have been the most awesome thing. Out. Like, what do you mean? What? I get to go out to LA and work on a TV show?
It was crazy.
Were you just out of your mind?
Out of my mind. Yeah. So yeah, basically during the day, I would just like drive golf carts around and take people down to set. And then sometimes they'd be like, try this weird wardrobe thing on so that we can see if the color looks right. But I was all pale and skinny and bluish white colored. And I was like, just don't show these pictures to anybody. And then, I just kind of like at the end of that was like, I just want to stay and work because I didn't get a job there. And I was probably going to go back to school, which would have been great. But from there, a friend of mine that had been like the office assistant on that show knew somebody over at Disney Feature Animation. And I was like, I'm going to go try and get in there as a PA and make my way in there. So then took that jump.
Boy, so it really is who you know, isn't it?
It's like a mix of like, you have to just have no fear, which I have a lot more fear now that I'm in my early
40s. I'm the same way. Like, I'm way worse now.
Yes.
Like, I got LASIK when I was 22. I would, like, it would terrify me now. But I just laid down and did it then.
No, I would definitely not do it now. Too much to lose. I at that time, it was just like, work my ass off. Plus, it was free. I had saved up a bunch of money, and I just kept pushing through. And yeah, I happened to know a person that was friends with somebody over at Disney. I interviewed there. I actually promised the person, to her credit, I won't say her name, but she was like, I will only give you this job as a PA if you promise to go back to school. And I was like, absolutely. And I just didn't do that. I just started working there.
Stay in school, kids.
Stay in school. So that, my first day there, I was a PA on Bug's Life. And so I was like the recording coordinator and PA on that. So
are you in the credits?
I'm in the credits for that and the credits for Tarzan, a bunch of crazy Disney movies.
That's awesome.
Era. Yeah, which is
so
crazy.
You ended up, before you get to where you are now the head of, co-head of your own studio, you worked for Disney on somehow three separate occasions?
Three times.
How does that happen?
It's a gift and a curse. I don't know. So the first time was feature animation, right?
Yeah.
So I worked there for I don't know, what did you find, 4 years? I can't remember.
that's the PA job?
Let's say, so it was a PA, then into a coordinator. So okay. I was like the effects coordinator on Tarzan was the last thing that I
cool.
did. But I was still only 21, 20. Yeah. I didn't even know what I was doing, really. And what I realized at that point in time was like I was climbing a totem pole that I didn't really know what I would do there, because within Disney, certainly at that time, you had to be like a story artist if you were going to have a creative impact on how the narrative worked, mm-hmm. Which I was not, or you had to be an animator or a variety of other things. So it was like there was this production path there that seemed cool, but these movies take, you know, for people that don't know, it's like 4 to 8 years to make an animated movie. Wow. So major, major commitment.
Yeah.
So after that period of time, that's when I was like, I want to get out of this. But I still did not know how to get into games at all. It was another kind of fluke.
What was thing. So was the games thing, was that just like always in the back of your head, like, man, I'd love to make video games?
Hyper passionate about games.
Yeah.
Like every aspect of my life was games from like outside. So, you know, I was a big like pen and paper guy, but not on D&D, on the Ninja Turtles RPG instead.
There was a pen and paper?
Oh, yeah.
That sounds
awesome.
Paper,
Ninja Turtles thing. And it was all like the old comic style. So hyper violent, you know, they're all tied up red.
Eastman and Laird
yes.
stuff.
Like, there was crossovers with ninjas and super spies and a few other things. And there was just this big, crazy... Yeah, thanks. So anyways. So,
wait, hold on. Do you roll, are you playing one of the turtles in this pen and paper? Or you make your own character?
You make your own. And I made...
Who were you?
His name was... This is horrible. His name was Nemad, which was Damien backwards.
Yeah.
I was 13. Don't hate. He was scaly. He had blades coming out of everything. He was covered in blood. My mom probably should have called the police.
What was he a mutation of?
It was like everything.
Everything.
It was like when you go to Subway and put all the soda in one cup.
Right.
I had that mentality.
And so you drew them in some like notebook paper.
Drew them in notebook paper. Yeah. Rolled a bunch of dice.
Yeah.
Here we go.
That's cool.
And it was like, yeah, he would go and, you know, stop drug deals and in warehouses, things like that, as mutants do.
So games are always in the back of your head. You're
Absolutely.
Playing games, pen and paper, and video game.
Yes.
So was there? What made you want to be a game developer? Was it that sort of that love that was always there combined with this sort of production path in entertainment that's not going quite where you want it to go? Or where does it come from?
Exactly that. And I will say, looking back, it probably seems like it all fell into place with a major plan in place. But it was more like I knew I wanted to stay in LA. I knew I wanted to work in entertainment and or games.
Yeah.
I was looking for games jobs, but at that time, this is like 99, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in 99, there wasn't a very clear path. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go to USC and have this huge game career that's going to, you know, sprout from that. It was everybody's path back then was very odd, right?
Yeah.
So I, at that time, it's another one of these things where it was like somebody that I had worked with during the Sunset Beach era, she had mentioned to me that she had a friend who was also like a coordinator over at Universal Interactive at
yes.
the time. So Universal Interactive was this perfect kind of crossover for me because I had the experience of where I had just been the last few years on the film side, and Universal Interactive was on the lot. They, you know, this is when they were still working with Insomniac and working with Naughty Dog. Mark Cerny was like just leaving as the head of Universal Interactive at that time.
Yeah.
And I interviewed there for like an associate producer gig. And it wasn't even a design thing at all. It was much more on the production path. And it just worked. It just happened.
You're in your early 20s at this point.
21. Maybe 22.
And so in my notes, it's you ended up heading up a team that was working on a platformer for Universal. Is that correct?
So that is correct. So in the very beginning, I was working on a couple of the Crash spinoffs, and these were the bad Crash spinoffs. You know, the moment when Naughty Dog is like, bye, and then it's like, here's a really whack PS2 game or whatever. So I was working on that, doing some design work and working as an associate producer. But Microsoft at that time, this is before the first
Way
Xbox
before
came
Xbox,
out, right?
Yeah.
And they were kind of going to publishers and developers and going like, you are great at this, so we want to partner with you on this. So they're going to go to EA to try to get a great sports game.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to us because platformers were still really a big deal, right? And so our whole kind of production crew started to pull together these various pitches. And I, over the course of a weekend, just go nuts and write this ridiculous pitch about a ferret that has been kidnapped by a torturous kid, and he's kept in a cage under a bed, and the kid watches all these violent kung fu movies, and so the ferret steals a Bic pen and some yarn and a paper clip, and he breaks out, he fights all these cockroaches, and then he goes on this animal liberation movement. So it's like this like dirty Toy Story type of a platformer that had stealth in it, and it was called Ferris. So I pitched this to Microsoft, and they greenlight it. And I'm like, what? Because I don't know what the hell I'm doing still. Like, I'm just sort of winging it. And we're like, we're going to find a developer to work with on this thing. And so that's essentially what happened.
I mean, like, this is the age of impossible, right? So it's like, I guess
that was it.
Sounds like it's good to go. Like, all right, green light. Let's do this.
It was insane. So we initially, it was with Bizarre Creations. You remember Bizarre?
Of course. I mean, Project Gotham Racing.
Incredible.
Blur. I mean, what an incredible studio.
Yeah. So, so great to work with. Super, super talented. And so this was, I think, right after they did Fur Fighters. So they were like a really good kind of fit for that.
That would have been probably, I think, maybe pre-Metropolis Street Racing. That was sort of before they hit
like
the racing.
Like 2 years before. I think PGR was already out. But which one came first?
Metropolis. MSR was first,
MSR was first, and that led to PGR. So then I work on this game for like a year. They give me a budget. I'm the producer and lead designer on it. I'm spending all this time out in the UK. I'm just a child.
Are your parents, like, when you call home to tell your parents what's going on, like, are they, like, just stunned at what you're, like, do they just think that California is this magical place, or that you're just this like, golden, Midas touch
child? Like, I don't know.
What did your parents think?
I don't know. Every time I was going back home, though, it was odd. It was very odd because I was like, this is working out. And there's certainly low times, you know, I'm just talking through the highlights, but like that part was crazy because, I'm flying to the UK all the time. So then I think right around then, so Sly Cooper comes out, a few other games come out that are in that general genre, but like three or four come out that bomb. Yeah. I can't remember the names of them, but a few of these big budget platformers come out, and then Universal pulled the plug. Mm-hmm. So that was it. We're like a year in, and I had blown all this money, and the game just sort of died, which sucked. So then I kind of I flip back over working on more Crash stuff, but working on the better ones, so that was fun.
Yes.
doing design work and production work on those, and then then we can go into 50 Cent.
You worked on the first one, Bulletproof.
Yes.
Just before we get to that, just licensed game, because you worked on and I think a lot of licensed games over the years.
Like 20, probably.
That's a lot.
Yeah, a ton.
You know, that to me, to a gamer who just sort of sees the final product, it seems like working on a licensed game would be a total nightmare, where you just have fixed budget, fixed time, and you better get it done or else. Because most of them over the years, I guess up until recently when people have started to put more money and time into these things, but they always had the reputation of being kind of just
horrible.
Terrible.
Yes. I mean, they still mostly do, right?
I guess it's mostly they get kind of pushed to mobile now.
Yes.
It's not as true. We don't see them as much on the console side, but
yes.
Yeah, what's like, do you know as you're a mobile game developer that you just know that you just have to make the best of a tough situation, or do you think like, yeah, this is good. I'm going to make this awesome. This is going to be great. And then it somehow goes horribly awry. Like, what is the mindset?
It's super different every time.
Okay.
So, like, all those logistics you're talking about timelines and budgets and all that, those are all awful, certainly. But even on top of that, it's like, how much feedback or direct line of communication do you have with the license holder is critical, right? So, like, even recently, like, we did the Mr. Robot game through our studio at Night School.
Yes.
That went great because we worked directly with their whole team, and it was very fast and fluid, and they trusted us, and we trusted them. And, like, these people who have these licenses or the creators of these shows, they don't want to make something shitty. Like, they want to make great stuff, right? So it's about all the layers in between, usually, and it's also about how risky do you want to get with it. So in the case of the 50 Cent game, that went really awry, like the first one.
I got to hear about that because, first of all, like, do you volunteer for this? Are you assigned to it? Like, how does it come about?
Well, before that, here's the worst licensed game, The Grinch. Okay, I worked on The Grinch. PS1, it was Dreamcast PS1 can't remember what else, maybe N64. And I don't mean to say it's the worst game, but that is the example that you're speaking of, I think, where it's like, it's just, the timelines are bad, everything is sort of bad. And on that one, you know, to all credit to A2M, who was the developer on it, I think they're called Behavior now. I think they changed the name, But it was like, how do we do a Spyro clone in 10 months? And it was sort of like, that's hard as hell, that's going to be a nightmare, but it's kind of a fun challenge. Like, you actually aren't, you know, hating on yourself at the moment. You're just more like, this is crazy, let's get gung-ho and go do it. And the thing that I tell a lot of people is like, making a bad game is almost exactly as hard as making a good game. Like, the amount of effort and the amount of intelligent people and the amount of, like, vision that goes into those games is very akin to some of our favorite games. It's just that those teams aren't afforded a lot of the opportunities, and they're getting focus tested to death, and they've got a boardroom full of people who are shooting things down, so...
So you're getting noted to death?
Yes, like, nonstop, right? And so I think... For a game like that, you know, that's going to inherently put out a product that's not that great. But in, like I said, you know, in the case of the Mr. Robot game, that worked out really well. And there can be sort of any spectrum in between.
Right.
50 was weird because I was like initially sort of the internal flag waver just behind like, let's make a thing. Like, we should do this. And Interscope Records was basically part of the big same parent company. So that's why that all started.
Okay.
And at the time, Interscope was like, we want to make a game. We think that this guy is going to be huge. And the more we looked into it, it was like, yeah, this does, I mean, he's going to blow up. Get Rich or Die Trying hadn't come out yet.
Yep.
He was, you know, obviously under the tutelage of Dre and Eminem. And so then it turned into like, okay, let's get behind it. We actually started making a much bigger game. It was like an open world GTA clone.
Wow.
Initially with another studio that I don't know if I should mention, but they're a great studio.
Yeah.
That got really far along, far enough along. Then it got canceled. And then at the last minute, it was like, we still need to make this game for Interscope. So fast forward, 50 Cent Bulletproof is another one of these like 11 month titles, right? I mean, it's like a brutal timeline. So the team there, like I mentioned earlier, when you talk about people that do great work, that are working their butts off, like the lead designer went on to do Darksiders 1 and 2.
Wow.
Like, most of that team went on to do really incredible things, but just had a lot of challenges thrown at them.
Man. And what? How do you feel about that game now? Like,
it was fun. No, I mean, the game was not fun. Working on the game was a blast. I think the game is what we all think it is. It's like a pretty bad third-person shooter. I think that Blood in the Sand ended up being much better. Well, I left before that really.
I was going to say, like, if you tell people you worked on the 50 Cent game, does everyone immediately think it was
like,
it was Blood in the Sand? You're like, yeah, that game was cool. I'm like, oh, well, it wasn't that
one. How about
one?
The other one? Yeah, no, we were ideating that one right before I left. So we would sit in the room, we're like, what's the most outlandish, ridiculous setting? And, you know, like, I think a lot of people, I think some of the charm of that game is that people are still like, do people know that this is hilarious? Everybody that worked on it knew it was hilarious. Like, this was not intended to be serious. It was very tongue-in-cheek. But, like, the first game, I mean, we had, so the writer of Bulletproof was Terry Winter, who is the creator of Boardwalk Empire. He wrote Wolf of Wall Street. He was the exec producer of Sopranos. It was like that caliber, you know? And then, like, I got to direct Dr. Dre. So it was, I liked working on it. The game's not great, but it was fun to work on.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So let's fast forward. When and how do you connect with your cousin Adam, who'd worked at Telltale on, coincidentally, probably my two favorite Telltale games, Wolf Among Us and Tales from the Borderlands? And decide to start your own independent studio.
So we connected when he was born, for years we had wanted to work together. So we actually worked at the same company most of that decade. Like, he was at Universal doing QA while I was there. When I was at Disney Interactive, he was there.
So he,
like,
had the
we were kind of always around.
Development bug too.
He had the bug as well. And I think that, you know, up until then, there was just not a natural path to us doing it. We had talked about maybe we write a movie together, maybe we do this, maybe we do that, but, like, digital distribution had not really taken off yet. Unity wasn't really a thing. So, like, there was no way for us to do that. And about, I don't know, maybe, I guess this is 2011-ish, I actually went up and interviewed at Telltale to be a creative director there. Didn't get that gig, but we kept, and he was there at the time.
Okay.
Adam was already there. And at that point, that was the light switch where we were both like, we want to do something special together. Let's figure it out and let's be very aggressive about it. Like, now it's time to shit or get off the pot.
Yeah.
So we spent about 6 months ideating what we'd want to do. This is while I was still at Disney. He was at Telltale. And then I got laid off at Disney. And then that was the perfect, like, kick to get things rolling, basically, because I had a 2-year-old daughter, and it was like, you know, you have basically 5 months before you burn through all your savings.
Right.
Let's get this thing off the ground. And so we pulled together like a business plan and the general structure of Oxenfree in that period of time.
Did one or the other convince? Like, who was leading the charge on that effort? Because that's a big decision.
It's a huge decision, especially when he was already gainfully employed
yeah,
while I was without a gig. I mean, we had been talking about it for months prior to that, but it was almost more of a cathartic thing in the beginning. You know, when you work somewhere, you're like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we did this, if we did that?
Yeah.
But then it really started to coalesce, and then when that layoff happened, it was like, I'm going to do it. So he basically said to me, he's just like, I trust you. I'll like, let me know when these things are really starting to come together. And we worked at night a lot on what a proposal would look like and how we could actually go out and raise some money to try and get a game.
That was
done.
The next thing I wanted to ask
yeah,
you. It's like,
yeah.
You know, I've had a million developers in here and it's fascinating to me every time, but like, How do you go get money? That, like, it's not cheap to set up shop. I mean, you probably, I don't know how many employees you guys have. I'm sure it's a dozen
or
more.
We're up at 13 now.
13,
but back
okay.
then we were four. So.
But still, it's like you got to pay people. You got lawyers for, you know, all the 401k
so
and all this and that.
You
like
toilet
but,
paper.
But first, you
got
to raise. Like, so who do you even target? Do you have to go to? Do you start like at a bank, or do you look at like investment firms? Or
it's a great question. For this specific thing, it was another case of making the most of prior working relationships. So
well, you're like a charmed man. You know that, right?
Like I had left games for 5 years in the middle of everything we talked about, and
yeah.
went to work on the marketing side of things, and so. I worked at a marketing agency. I wrote like a bunch of ARGs, which you know what an ARG is, yeah. So did a bunch of creative work for games and film on the marketing side, and decided that I wasn't a marketing person. Like I was okay in that space, and I got the entrepreneurial itch from doing that because you're out pitching and you're
yeah.
getting shot down all the time. But ultimately, when I left, the head of one of those agencies that I had worked at, we left on really good terms. And he
good.
Was like, if you ever want to work together again, let me know. So he, in the very beginning, when I was pitching Night School, it was actually to be an extension of his agency. Now, he was really interested in that, but then he was like, we as an agency have our own identity crisis, because agencies are like, we do this, we do that, we do other things. Why are we making new IP video games? So at the last minute, he kind of was more like, we'll put a little bit in, but you got to go raise the rest of
sure.
it. And then that was just a crazy hunt for folks. Now, the amount that I asked for was enough for four people to work for a year and a half, right? So it wasn't overly crazy.
Right.
But fortunately, they trusted me enough to have what at the time was probably a pretty simplistic business plan, because we really were just like, let's make the coolest possible game that
yeah.
we adore, and we'll put it out. There's no free-to-play hooks. It's just going to make something really cool. And that's how it came together over the course of those 6 months.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
So what lessons and wisdom does Adam impart from his time at Telltale? Either good or bad, right? Like, yeah. Oh, this totally worked. We should do this, or let's make sure to not do this at all. I'm sort of curious because, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is a while ago. Telltale obviously and unfortunately ended very badly, which I mean, in my opinion, certainly seemed to have been poor management from the top that sunk the studio. So, what were there some sort of obvious lessons that you guys had learn to live by right away?
So only the creative ones, not the business ones early on. The creative ones, it was more like, how can we siphon his learnings about branching narrative design that he got there in the short time that he was there? Because I think he was there for like a year and a half, two years. But he still oversaw a ton of projects there. And they had a lot of great process in place in terms of like how to reinforce player agency and how to really get choices making sense. And so and he's just a great writer. And so I think in the beginning, it was like, how do we take that from what they require 200 people to make, and how do we let 4 people do it? And how do we like distill that? Because in the beginning, we were just like, I think we talked for a while about going, how do you take Limbo and The Walking Dead and mix them together? That was like the mission statement.
That's a killer elevator pitch right there.
And that's really what we were pitching. It was like Limbo and The Walking Dead. Like, what if you're playing Limbo and you can talk while you're doing it? And then that got us this momentum. But, you know, over time, I think it was less about when he started there, and it was more like, because we worked with them on the Mr. Robot game and on an unannounced thing that ended up going down when they went down.
Yeah.
And during that time, it was then we really realized, like, just stay lean and stay innovative.
Yeah, because you guys didn't get paid for that, is what I read.
There was a chunk that we did not, right. So that was rough.
Was that scary? Like, hopefully you planned for that? I mean, I can't imagine having a client that can't or won't pay.
When we're that small, it's like a blow to the side of the ship that is almost, you can barely recover from it. So fortunately, you know, we have so far still sort of mixed doing original IP and then doing some outside like client work here and there. And so like NBC Universal with Mr. Robot and then the Mummy game that we made, which let's just skip over that one.
Isn't that kind of Hollywood thing of like, one for them, one for us?
It's literally sort of like that, yeah. And, you know, there's licenses that we would want to, like, knock out of the park, and those ones we wanted to do as well. But, like, we are not allergic to working with partners who will keep us safe and who are good to work with, you know? Yeah. So, when that happened, it was terrifying.
So, Night School spinning up, which, by the way, so does the name Night School come from the fact that you guys started by working in the evenings?
You know
on it?
What? I wish it was that. It's just, we're like, it sounds cool. I swear to God, it was more like, it's evocative of a little bit of that.
You know, you can set your own narrative right now. You can
actually.
Just...
No, it was really like, it was just that vision of like, there's youthfulness, there's stuff going on after hours.
Yeah.
There's all of that, but there's no hyper specific thing. Yeah.
So did the idea for Oxenfree sound like, did that come right at the studio's onset? Like you had that going in, like that was your and Adam's idea heading into this whole thing?
It was there were two
things. I'm gonna refill you, by
Please
the way.
Do.
Let's see how
giving thee the eye. good pour.
That's a little better.
A little better.
There we go.
That's a great pour.
Okay, not bad,
it's
right?
A great pour.
I don't do this for a living.
Thank you. Look at that. That's a really good pour. We had two ideas that we wanted to somehow merge. One was just a pure design idea, which was like, how can we make story the toy?
Yeah.
So like, if every other studio is going, story is this connective tissue between what the real gameplay is, we were like, how do we just make the gameplay story? And so communication and all of that was like a thing that we wanted to make sure there was no cutscenes, we never took control away from the player, and there was more like an ability for the player. And so from that, knowing how small we were like, well, let's start to develop ideas for a story that a team this small can make. So a desolate island is a pretty good place for something like that. A small cast is a pretty good place for something like that. Them not having machine guns and rocket launchers is probably pretty cost effective for us. And so, on the other side of that, like, we're just huge fans of like Spielbergian 80s teen, preteen stuff. And it wasn't overly saturated yet. Like, Stranger Things hadn't come out. None of that was really out yet when we started, because it was 2014, like, mm-hmm. right when we were starting. And so those two things just kind of kept feeding each other. It's like the toy is talking, and we want a bunch of teens who are dealing with teen coming of age stuff.
Yeah.
And we kept going, but the ghostly nature of it, that came later. We didn't have that yet.
So at what point during the project, I always love asking this question of everybody that's made something cool, when do you know that you have something special? Is it like on paper up front, like, this is going to be great, or is it not until gamers are playing it, like, or somewhere in between? I'm always curious.
It is an emotional roller coaster, because in the very beginning you're like, oh, I got something really special here, and then you start to sort of like dig in a bit and you go, oh, there's a lot of problems under here that we have to solve, that even though we thought we were picking the simplest thing, it's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And then you solve a bunch of those problems, you go, oh, this is incredible. And so, like, for us, from the outset, we're like a coming of age story where you determine how the player comes of age and you can talk freely the whole time. That, we were like, we're onto something. But about halfway through the game, we're like, this game sucks. Like, we're dead in the water, because none of the performances were in yet. It was way more complicated to make than we expected. Like, there's so much performance in the characters' animations. There's so much in terms of, like, how do you convey fear and tension when the camera is so far away,
right,
and we don't have the language of film to work with, where we're cutting between people. And so for a long period, it was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And then right towards the end, we're like, okay, this feels special. So it's definitely a roller coaster.
Huh. So by the time you shipped it, you felt really good about it.
Yes. Although even then it was like, the game was so synonymous with the studio, we didn't even really think, I mean, Night School was a studio, but really we were like, we're the people making Oxenfree together. And if it doesn't do well, we're going to just go get other jobs. But if it does do well, oh shit, we got a studio. I got to make some more things. And
yeah.
So right when it came out, we had something we were proud of, but we didn't know if it would resonate. But yeah, we felt great about it.
Well, on a sort of the other side of that same coin, I'm curious, you know, is it frustrating at all to try and cut through the noise as an independent studio, you know, knowing that you have something you feel really good about, to just try and get noticed when there are like 5,000 other great independent titles that are publishing to PC and consoles on an almost literal daily basis?
Yes, it's terrifying. It continues to get even more terrifying. I think one of the things that probably helped from just that stint that I did on the marketing side was understanding at least where to start with an idea that is big and not so esoteric that it's hyper-focused on just a particular group of gamers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a way that we could communicate Oxenfree that would sound very focused, but there's another version where you just go, you know, it's a playable Freaks and Geeks and Poltergeist mixed together, and how do we communicate the game that way and give that promise? And so that's not just like how you message the game, but even like our art style, for example. At that time, pixel art is still huge, but like at that time it was like the biggest thing from like 2012 to 2015. And we were like, let's intentionally go left. Even though we love those types of games, we want to look different, make it look like we are, you know, somebody that would be talked about with the other big boys. So,
right.
Like, I think Cappy does a great job of that and has always done a great job of that. Like, they are an indie studio that has, that is always talked about in sort of the AAA conversation.
True.
We kind of leaned into that, and we continue to try to do that.
So, what sort of similar question of from a minute ago, was there a point where you felt like, you know, you're about to put it out into the wild and you feel like, all right, I think we have some good visibility and some good awareness here? Or is it still just terrifying to are you sitting there going, is anyone even going to notice this game?
It's definitely terrifying even once it's out, right? So, like, we got pretty good reviews, so that helped. But even then, it's like, how do you get people to latch on to the aspects of the game that we think they should latch on to? And with a game like Oxenfree that has so much sort of mystery behind the story,
we were very precious, I think, early on in all the wrong ways. We were like, check this out, isn't it mysterious? And then didn't really convey what was happening in the game. And over time, we changed how we messaged that. So like when the PS4 version came out a few months after the Xbox and PC version, we leaned into the mind-bendiness of the game. And yeah, we leaned into the time loops and the puzzles and all of that intrigue and kind of pulled back from some of the things that were more kind of generic, because it's not a horror game. We don't want to sell it as a horror game. So you just find ways. I think for us, one of the biggest things was like talking to the community a lot and understanding what they love, because for us, we're like, it's a jambalaya of a lot of stuff we love, mm-hmm, but maybe there's only three things that people are really resonating with. So you just change the message based on that.
And do you feel like that worked on the with the PS4 version?
Absolutely. Yeah. So even before the PS4 version came out, we were realizing that people were replaying the game, and we hadn't built in any sort of like reward structure for that. And we're like, oh, because during Adam's time at Telltale, he was like, people barely play through these things a first time. They definitely don't play through a second time. We started looking at our metrics. We're like, people are playing Oxenfree 1.5 times on average.
Wow.
So they're usually playing 2-3 if they're really into it. And we're like, there's nothing there for that. So we built the New Game Plus version then that really fit nicely with the fiction of the game, because there are time loops, and we found a way to make it feel like that's the complete version of the game, and yeah, then it just blew up. It really blew up after that.
I love hearing that. So, to the one more thing on the discoverability thing, because it's a fascinating topic to me as somebody. Mm. I mean, it's a big part of my job. I'm the previews editor here. It's my job to try and filter, you know, what IGN should cover that's coming up. And you know, back when I worked at Official Xbox Magazine, it was a lot easier, both in terms of it was a single platform, just Xbox, and there weren't, like, we could literally look at every single game that came onto Xbox. Now, with even if I did just cover Xbox here, because of ID at Xbox, there are developers constantly putting out stuff every single day. So I tell you, I've spent a lot of this generation telling Phil Spencer in person when I get the chance, like, hey, bring back Xbox Live Arcade, like, yes, a curated, you know, weekly, regular thing where people know just every Wednesday I'm going to get some new stuff that's been handpicked, probably really cool Xbox Live Arcade games on the 360. Like, I would love to see that come back now with you know, nothing against ID at Xbox, but things just come out and there's no way to really know, like, what's good and what's not. Are you with me on this? Would you like to see the platform holders kind of do some curation? I mean, Apple's trying to do this with Arcade, with their Apple Arcade, and that's looks like they might be off to a good start with that. But as someone who makes independent games, that are you with me?
That would thrive on that.
Yeah.
Well, as a consumer, 100%. And then as somebody that's running a studio, 100%. Yes. But I think it's, you know, like there's a double-edged sword, right? Like,
yeah,
there's for the smaller teams, maybe they're not going to be able to get as much recognition. But
true,
there's such a fire hose of content out there all the time now, and it's hard to differentiate when you've only got, you know, a second of somebody's attention span to understand what the promise of that game is. So the platform holders, like, in particular, really, yeah, Xbox and Apple now are taking steps towards that, which feels really good.
How, you know, before we move on to After Party, that is why you're here. You're not here for your health. You're not here for a psychiatric analysis, which hopefully that's not what this feels like. But I'm just sort of curious, like, obviously Oxenfree has done well enough that you're making another game, but how, like, how did it do for you guys? You know, you've reduced the price. It's $10 on any platform now, and it's on just about every platform. But
get it.
Are you thinking, oh, maybe we should put this on Apple Arcade or a Google Stadia? Like, are you kind of still looking at ways to keep the Oxenfree train rolling? And yeah, how has it done for you guys?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that has been the biggest learning experience for me over this whole studio is, like, as much as you can do that is independent, the better you are off as a studio. And I don't mean that in a weird control freak way.
Right.
I mean that in, like, we created Oxenfree, we own Oxenfree, and now that is a thing that we can pull levers on whenever we want. We can put it on sale, we can put it on whatever platform we want, and it continues to grow, and we want to keep building, like, evergreen franchises and games that don't feel particularly like, oh yeah, that obviously came out in 2015, 2016. And so Oxenfree was a slow burn. Like, it didn't just take off immediately. I think it took about a year before it was like, it really found its footing.
Interesting.
But then once it did, it just like snowballed. And I think
that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's been great. We've done over a million units
across
multiple platforms. Yeah, and that's like sold. And then, but from things like Game Pass and elsewhere, I think it's like installed over 3 million times. So it's pretty crazy.
Is there a Switch version? Remind me.
There is a Switch version.
Yeah, yes. Okay.
That's probably the optimal way to play it, I would say.
I mean,
yeah, it's pretty, for me, I love playing it that way.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Because you have touch controls and the joysticks.
True.
Joy-Cons.
So we move to After Party now. You go from teenagers trying not to die to young adults who are dead.
Unfortunately.
So. I ask you, with all due respect, as we sit here with beers, did the idea for this game where you're trying to outdrink Satan to escape hell, did it come about while you were sober?
No.
No.
No. Neither did the ferret game from earlier in our conversation. So After Party, really where it started was we wanted to try to build a game that was just in a bar. We thought that would be a fun thing to do, right? Like, I'm the idiot who goes into a Skyrim pub and just hangs out there and drinks and watches the animation sway in Red Dead. And like, I love that, right? And I was like, nobody is making the most of pubs and bars as a setting. And at that time, I think we were about maybe a year after Papers, Please had come out. And Papers, Please was another thing where we were like, what an efficient, brilliant game, because you can have all of these different walks of life come into a single location and have a story come out of that, right? Which is very different from what we had done before. And so we were like, well, let's make a bar game. And then in the beginning, it was just like, well, what could you do? Could you be a bartender? And then, as you've seen, pouring beers isn't all that fun. So we're like, let's do the drink in the bars, and then that sort of snowballed, and the hell, you know, stuff that came a little bit later. But ultimately, we thought, as a studio that wants story to be the core of your interactions, drinks could be a really fun way to augment a dialogue system, to augment abilities, to augment all of this. It's like an RPG mechanic, basically.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah. So then the funny part, this is very odd. So there's a cemetery called Forest Lawn across from our studio, and it's massive. Anybody that has been to LA, it's like, I don't know, 3 miles across, literally. And so everybody's buried there, and it's this sprawling, crazy place. And we'll walk over there and brainstorm sometimes. And Adam and I were just walking past some giant crypt, and we're like, wouldn't it be cool if you were dead doing this? We're like, that's stupid. And then maybe 2 hours later, we're like, what if you had to outdrink Satan? That's really stupid. Then a week later, we're like, no, that's pretty cool. Like, we should do this. And then it all just came together after that. We really started working on that. That was a little over 2 years ago.
That's so cool. Was there ever any thought to trying to maybe continue Oxenfree's story and keep that going?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are still thoughts about that. Yes, we know what we would want to do with that if we did that too. So we're still thinking that through. But like, I think, you know, with After Party, it is almost like it's not a spiritual successor, but you'll see, like, as people play the game, it's not just this like surface ridiculous pub crawl through hell, which it is all of that, but it's really like this exploration of Milo and Lola's friendship and why they died and how they died and teasing out trauma, but in a fun way. Like, it's a comedy, but ultimately when people play this, they're going to go, oh, this is a direct descendant of Oxenfree.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Game Pass for a second. So you're on Game Pass now with Oxenfree, and you are launching After Party into Game Pass, which I mentioned at the top of our conversation here, among the other platforms. So as much as you are legally allowed or willing, I'm genuinely curious, because I actually hear this a lot from, you know, I host our Xbox podcast here every week, and there's a lot of fans, gamers, that kind of go, how does that work as far as like you guys keeping the lights on and being successful? Like, so how do the economics of Game Pass work? Like, you are launching a brand new game day one into Xbox Game Pass. How does that work for your studio?
So we wouldn't have even done it if Oxenfree didn't do so well via Game Pass. So what happened with Oxenfree was like, we ultimately, Oxenfree had come out via ID at Xbox. We already had a great relationship with them. And prior to Game Pass launching, they were like, we want to flesh out this catalog. There are some terms that I can't talk about
Fair
specifically,
enough.
But it's not like they're just like, bring it over here for free. So there's, you know, you could imagine that there's a reason why we would do it. And it came out, and what I was worried about was, is this going to cannibalize other sales early on? Like, that was the main
sure.
concern, right? You go, well, if this is going to be out on the same platform that it, like, I want people buying it on Xbox still. But what we found was, not only when it came out on Xbox or on Game Pass did it like not do that, it also increased our sales everywhere else on every platform. Because I think what happened was, like, the discoverability that you're talking about,
yeah.
certainly when Game Pass first came out, it had a more limited catalog, but I think it's the least friction imaginable for somebody who's looking for a new game. So they
right.
heard about Oxenfree. They're like, eh, maybe I don't want to spend the money on it. They try it. They play it. Ideally, they fall in love with it. They tell their friends about it. And we got a ton more installs across the board everywhere.
That's awesome.
So it was great. So with After Party, when they reached out to us, they were like, we've had a great partnership with you guys previously. We structured a somewhat similar deal. But ultimately, it's the kind of thing where it's weird. I don't, like, nobody... Nobody at Microsoft has told me to say this, but it really is like one of the best things to happen for the game industry.
I completely
feel like
agree.
It's incredible. Yeah.
I think in 5 years, this will be the
just the
industry norm and
yeah.
we'll look back on buying games as a probably mm-hmm. a weird thing. But so is it, are there like, maybe you can't say, but are there multiple sort of options? Like, is it like an upfront payout to say like, okay, we're going to make sure that you guys are comfortable and then you don't get anything else from there, and it's sort of like, right. we're going to make you comfortable and that's it? Or is it like a, do you get kind of a little piece? I guess I just don't understand
goes.
Sort of, for the financial health of the studio, what, I don't know, you know, without specifics, obviously, like,
sure.
can you kind of speak in general terms of how it's advantageous
I think
to you
it
guys?
Is, so it might be different for other studios, honestly. Like,
yeah.
maybe they've all negotiated totally different types of deals. For us, it's very similar to what I hear selling a show to Netflix feels like. So, like, for us, that's kind of how the structure feels. But it's been, I bet for other people, it's different. I don't know.
So it's effectively, you're removing some of the risk. You're raising your floor and lowering your ceiling, maybe? Is that a fair generalization?
I would just say, yeah, because I can't go into specifics,
yeah.
but I would say it just offsets a lot of risk for us in a category that wouldn't otherwise even be problematic. That's
right.
kind of why we make that decision, because it's like, we still know that we will be able to sell and sell well on Xbox. And that's the part where I wouldn't have ever signed up for this unless we tested it on the Oxenfree front.
Yeah.
But Microsoft has been an extraordinary partner, and they're very fair in their deal, and that's basically it, yeah. But, like, it's... Like, the decision-making process for us comes less down to how can we be aggressively monetizing over some crazy long-term, and more about, like, how do we just make the right footprint in the right places? And when it comes to Game Pass, that was, like, just, it just felt right.
So you're getting a lot more eyes on the game, which will in turn lead to more sales for hopefully After Party and probably for Oxenfree too.
Exactly.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's something that what we've found when I was talking before about being overly precious about certain things. The same way that I used to be really paranoid about streamers playing through our game and spoiling it for people, now I'm like, it just doesn't matter. And on the Xbox or on the Game Pass front, it's like, this is the way to get a ton of eyeballs on this thing, and ideally loving it and having it be a part of, like, them caring about our studio moving forward, right?
Yeah.
Like, it meant a lot for us to now have a name for them.
You get right. fans.
Exactly. To look forward to the next thing. Yeah.
So, that's awesome. Do you see, do you see people that play on Game Pass, do a lot of them buy the game, even though they already have it on? Do they, like, go ahead and convert that to full ownership?
Because Game Pass can run out, we've seen a lot of people then, if they don't continue with their subscription, they do that. Or what we found is that they'll end up buying it on other platforms, too.
Nice,
so they'll,
okay,
like,
yeah.
double, triple dip across
yes.
the board. Yeah.
Oh, that's
so been really cool. Like, I think there's something about the size of our game and, like, just the genre that makes people sort of feel like, I kind of want to own this on two or three
yeah.
platforms.
You want to hang on to it forever.
Right, right.
And that means you've done something right, if people feel that way.
Hopefully.
Yes. all right, just a couple more questions, and
yeah.
I will let you go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're 1.5 beers in. This is the solid.
that you know of.
So you mentioned early in the interview LucasArts point-and-click adventure games, which are extremely near and dear to me as well. I'm so fortunate to have met Tim Schafer, somebody who works three blocks from here at Double Fine, and I try to stay professional in this job because I do take it seriously, but Tim's one of the people where I had to, I still had my original Full Throttle box from 1996. And, you know, one of the first times I ever got to meet him, I had him sign the box. And have you had a chance, because you mentioned LucasArts Adventure Games, have you met Tim or Ron Gilbert or any sort of your adventure game heroes, as it were?
I don't know Ron. I wish I did. I've met Tim on a number of occasions now. And yeah, the first time I met him, I was a blithering idiot. And fortunately now I think I've composed myself a little better each time that I see him. But no, he's great. He's like the humblest, kindest, coolest guy. And it's very hard for me to reconcile how important the games are that he's made and continues to make with where I am now. Because like a lot of what we do, obviously the DNA of a lot of what we do comes from that lineage.
What who are sort of your game industry heroes? You know, you said you've been playing since you were a little kid in Atari 2600. Are there designers that you've always really held in super high specific esteem?
Tim for sure. Mizuguchi is probably the biggest one, although that is he exists in such a different lane that we will never even attempt to try to compete in. But like, my God, Mizuguchi circa Dreamcast era is probably as important to me as a lot of the stuff we mentioned earlier. It's just that I was older playing that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, actually that's all I would say. I would start and end with Mizuguchi.
What do you hope gamers, again, October 29th?
Yes.
Game Pass?
PS4, Xbox, PC.
And what's if it's not Game Pass, what's the price? Are we
$19.99?
Okay. So that's the message that everyone should take away from this interview. But
and that the game is amazing. It's about two friends who die and go to hell and have to drink their way out of hell, like we're doing right now.
Wait, this is hell? We're in hell.
No, we're dead.
Oh, no. I've made some terrible choices along the way. But yeah, what are you hoping the gamers take away from After Party? What is your hope there?
I think at the highest level, just that they laugh, because it's a very different game than what Oxenfree was.
Yeah.
Like, we set out to make this game to feel more like a lean-back, watch Rick and Morty or, you know, BoJack Horseman with your friends on the couch, Adult Swim style of thing on the surface. And then the further you dig and the further you play through it, I think, I guess the next layer after having fun and laughing would be, oh, wow, this touched my heart even more than Oxenfree. There's a lot that we are not really talking about yet in terms of, like, the exploration of their friendship and why they're in hell and the nature of all these various people that are there. So I think there's going to be a lot of surprising stuff in the game. But ultimately, just I hope you laugh and have fun in it, because it really does, like, we feel like it feels like an episodic binge-worthy series on Netflix or something. If it like a crazy adult animated show.
Awesome. Who doesn't need a good laugh?
That's
right?
It. Now, for sure.
Television is mostly like awesome but serious dramas and comedy.
Have fun, need a good laugh. That's what, like, this game is inspired by, like, when we started Oxenfree, it was all the Spielberg stuff, like I said. This one, we were like, how do we make a Bill and Ted? How do we make a Beetlejuice? How do we make the Edgar Wright movies? You know, how do we, like, that type of a vibe? And that's, you know, there's a lot of those movies, but there's not a lot of those games. So we kind of wanted to make a playable version of that.
So you guys, Night School Studios just recently celebrated your 5-year anniversary. Congratulations on that. So, last question for you. What is the next 5 years look like? What's the plan? What's the hopes and dreams?
So there's a few things that are going on. One, this is the smallest thing possible.
Yeah.
We're making an after party beer.
Really?
I swear to God. We'll put it on this left
hand. Well, what is it?
I swear to God. It's
going
to be an IPA. We're very
IPA?
Early on. Yeah, it'll be an IPA.
All right.
We're early on that. But that's not the important stuff. We just want to keep making story games, but that story gets interacted with really differently each time, like that you haven't seen before. And I think for us, that means more original IP. Like, we have to, like, the reason Oxenfree works, the reason After Party works well, and that they don't feel like weird licensed games, is that the story idea was born from a set of mechanics, and the two kind of talk to each other.
Yeah.
And we just want to keep experimenting in that space. So, you know, we're not like, oh, we're a transmedia company. We're a game studio that wants to make fun, awesome games. But by the end of them, we hope you love our characters. So there will be certainly new IP, and there will likely be revisiting some other IP that already exists.
Nice teaser. I like that. Sean Crankle, the co-founder of Night School Studios. October 29th is the day you need to go on your platform of choice, except for Switch, because that'll come
soon-ish.
A little later, soonish.
Yes.
But jump on, play After Party, buy it for $20. If you're on Xbox and you get a Game Pass subscription, you can just download it and have fun. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was a blast. Thanks for being my first guest at the bar arcade slash barcade slash whatever I'm allowed to say or not
clean
say.
Up now.
Trademark. Yeah, we did okay. I think we did good. It was fun.
I agree.
For more from the best, brightest, and most interesting minds in the games industry, check back every month for new episodes of IGN Unfiltered.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.